I'd like to welcome everyone out this morning and to the Mesa City Council study session of Thursday, July 3rd, 2008. Prior to beginning the study session, we have a bit of formal business we need to take, and that is to conduct a meeting of the Enterprise Zone Commission. The Enterprise Zone is a zone which encompasses primarily areas in districts 3 and 4, and by law we need to and a little bit of one. I'm sorry, Councilmember Richens. I apologize. I know you feel hurt. Very sensitive. By law, we must hold this meeting periodically. Therefore, I'll call to order the meeting of the Enterprise Zone Commission. And the first item of business is to select a chairman and a vice chairman of the Mesa Enterprise Zone Commission. Do I have a motion? Councilmember Richens.
Mr. Mayor, to illustrate how strongly I feel about this, I would like to nominate others to chair this. I'd like to nominate Dennis Kavanaugh as the chair and Kyle Jones as the vice chair, as it does encompass most of their district for this Enterprise Zone Commission. I think they'll do a great job.
That is incredibly magnanimous of you to share
Thank you.
And therefore, we have a motion and a second by Councilmember Summers for Councilmember Dennis Kavanaugh as the chair and Vice Mayor Kyle Jones as the vice chair. Any discussion? Councilmember Fenter, are you with us?
Yes, sir, I am.
Good. Thank you very much. if there's no discussion, all in favor say aye.
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 Councilmember Fenter votes aye. The vote is unanimous in the affirmative. Thank you. The next item in this meeting is to hear a presentation and discuss and accept the City of Mesa Enterprise Zone Annual Report for the fiscal years of 2006 and 2007. Mr. Murphy, Mr. Jibjiniak.
Good morning, Mayor. Good morning, Council. As one of the economic development tools here in the city, we have a very short 7 or 8 slide presentation for you to review and hopefully adopt as we go forward for the fiscal year 06-07. Mr. Murphy, would you do the honors?
I will. Good morning and congratulations, Chair Kavanaugh and Vice Chair Jones. The purpose of this presentation is basically to fulfill a state requirement that the city conduct a minimum of 2 public meetings a year to discuss the activities conducted in the Enterprise Zone. As part of this presentation, we are recommending that you accept the fiscal year 06-07 annual report. In August, we'll present you the fiscal year 07-08 annual report. As mentioned earlier, the primary goal of the Enterprise Zone is to improve the economics of the enterprise of the specific areas within the state. This program does this by enhancing opportunities for private investments. Our Enterprise Zone was established in 2005. What you have before you is a map of the Enterprise Zone area. As Mayor Smith pointed out, it is primarily in West Mesa. Some of the benefits that a business can have if they're located within the Enterprise Zone is job tax credits. Basically, what that means is over a 3-year period, they can have credits up to $3,000 per employee, up to a maximum of 200 employees. There's also property tax benefits that could result in approximately 40 to 60% overall savings on the business state property tax bill. In order to qualify for those benefits, the business has to meet certain criteria. For the job tax credits, basically the business cannot have more than 10% of its business be retail. They also have to pay an hourly wage of at least $9.94 an hour. They have to offer health insurance to their employees and pay at least 50% of that health insurance cost. For the property tax benefits, it has to be minority owned. And then also make an investment in the property of at least $2 million. The benefits to the city is this is another economic development tool that we have to try to attract new business to the city and also retain businesses that are already in the Enterprise Zone. As mentioned earlier, the goal is to create jobs and also to assist our efforts to revitalize West Mesa. What's required of the city is the staff time to administer the zone. We also have to conduct 2 meetings a year. We promote the zone as well as submit an annual report to the Arizona Department of Commerce. As part of the report that's in your packet, basically what that points out is general information about what's going on in the Enterprise Zone. In the fiscal year 06-07 report, we pointed out that the city is starting to market some of its properties downtown to try to stimulate some reinvestment in the area. We also talk about how light rail is coming and that there's going to be a new station there and all the investment that that's occurring with that. And then that the city in fiscal year 06-07 initiated the West Main Area Plan. That's where we met with the business and property owners to develop a plan to help revitalize that area and capitalize on the light rail that's coming to the area. So basically what I'd like today is if you have any questions on the enterprise zone, please feel free to ask those. And then we're asking that you accept the fiscal year 06-07 report.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Mr. Richens.
Is Banner exempt from property tax already, the Banner Mesa property? Because I noticed that they fall within, and I don't know in some of their redevelopment if that encourages them to do anything there. The other site that I think is the AT&T site where it's underemployed, if there's opportunities there that we need to market out to that corporation to get them to add more employment to West Mesa in that area.
That's something we can look into. What I failed to mention, too, is we are basically expanding our business retention expansion program. And one of the things we put together is a list of eligible businesses that we think might be eligible for the enterprise zone. So we're going to be targeting those in the coming months with both a mass mail out as well as some one-on-one visits with them. So we'll include those.
Thank you.
Any other questions or discussion? Okay, I have a motion to approve to accept the City of Mesa Enterprise Zone annual report from Councilmember Richens, a second from Councilmember Summers. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Councilmember Fenter?
Aye.
The vote is 7-0 in the affirmative. The motion passes. Now I entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Vice Mayor Jones, second by Councilmember Summers. All in favor aye.
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 Any opposed? The Enterprise Zone Commission meeting is adjourned. We'll now move into the study session for Thursday, July 3rd, 2008. The first item on the agenda is to review the agenda for the council meeting for Tuesday, July 8th, 2008. Page 2, Councilmember Higgins.
Yes. Mayor, I just had a question. We have about 5 individual lot annexations on this agenda, and I wondered if, as a council, we might want to, if there's a mechanism to continue this process until the new council has a chance to review the policy we currently have in place and to see if that's something we all agree with.
Are you asking that perhaps that we continue these items or that we have a separate discussion on the overall policy and move forward with these items? Which one are you specifically asking?
Both. I'd like to hang on to these and discuss them all in further detail.
Vice Mayor.
However well-intentioned, I think it's inappropriate when the process is in place to, and people are already in the middle of that process, to back out on them. So I'm fine with looking at the ruling, but to take these particular properties that have gone through the process that was in place, I don't think it's appropriate to do that to them.
Mr. Brady.
Yeah, and the only, certainly council can choose to do that. I would suspect we have there's several others that we don't see here that are already in the process. The council, as a body, approved modifications to the annexation policy. Well, we've been doing it over the last couple of years. There may be several, and maybe Mr. Wesley can talk to that are in the process right now. So just postponing action on these, there could be several others that are in the process because relying upon previous policy, they may be forthcoming. We certainly could try to bring to council as soon as possible a discussion on annexation. I can tell you it is not a very simple discussion. It will take some time, I would suggest. So I don't know, John, what's your sense of what's still out there?
Mayor, Council, we have
a lot in the process right now. I'm thinking the number's around 70 that are someplace in the overall process from beginning to end.
Are these all lots?
Currently. Some are larger pieces. A lot of them are individual lots or a few lot owners that have come together.
So we have a lot of lots.
Well, that's correct, sir. That's okay. A very good way to say it. I guess my comment at this point with these, what's on here in terms of item three is the public hearing to release the petition. Once that petition is released, they have a year to get those signatures back to us. Our processing of them at that point does not follow necessarily a set schedule, and certainly no specific action is taken by this council until the ordinance is here for your consideration of adopting or not adopting. And so there are a lot of steps before we'd actually get to the point of council really taking action on these annexations for us to go on over the policy, discuss it, and see if there are any changes that are desired.
Councilmember Summers.
Thank you, Mayor. A bit of history from the previous council on why this was adopted. It went through the Transportation Infrastructure Committee, which I was chair, and I believe Councilmember Jones was also on. We had reviewed the policy. We had a number of very large county islands. Most of those are either on well, some of them even tank their water in, and a lot of them are on septic systems. Many of them would request service hookup, particularly from water, to their community. What we found was that there were a lot of issues related to providing the water. Once we started that contract, we had to continue it. We were not able to require any improvements or bring properties up to code when properties were improved. So we were extending services outside the city that then didn't come with it our ability to help those communities come up to a minimum standard. It's quite the difficult decision, but it seemed to us the balance of it was having those properties come into the city seemed to be the better alternative than to having them stay in the county and providing our services outside. It also stopped what was a slew of folks who had come in before the city and ask for those services to be provided outside, and we would lose in some cases hundreds if not thousands of dollars in state shared revenue because those citizens are part of the county, not part of the city. So by bringing these properties in, not only do we have some jurisdiction over those properties as far as development, but we also receive monies from the city for state shared revenue. Is it the best alternative? No, it does create some hassles, as Councilmember Higgins has pointed out, and we've certainly seen those as well. If we're going to look at a policy or re-review this policy, I'd suggest that we send it back to the Transportation Infrastructure Committee for some education, and then at a later point, if we want, we can bring it to full council.
Councilmember Higgins? Oh. I turned on.
I would like to look deeper into those issues.
Yeah, and I can appreciate, and I remember when it was discussed, and I think it's completely appropriate for this council to look at it. What was decided yesterday may or may not apply today, and that's not to say that what we're doing now is right or wrong, but it is the policy. And so I would have no problem, and I think, I have some questions to whether the ideals and the objectives that that previous councils have tried to achieve still are relevant or still the same objectives that we want to achieve, and things may have changed. So I would support reviewing the entire policy. But those that have started under the current policy, I think you're okay with them going through. And once again, this is not a decision on these. This is simply to set in motion a process which could take up to a year. Is that correct, Mr. Wesley? Councilmember?
And I agree, Mayor. I think it's been a year, maybe a year and a half since this is, maybe not even that.
Well, we've done various iterations. I mean, the council just recently approved new annexation fees and the types of fees are associated, which will also dictate really a real strong review by those seeking annexation because the cost of doing that and our ability to recover other associated development costs have been just approved by the council too. So it just depends on which iteration you're speaking to.
Personally, this was an imperfect solution to what is certainly a problem, and having it reviewed by tick with the new information we've gathered over this last year and see if this really was the right policy moves. I think absolutely the right move. So,
yeah, and I think it's something that the committee can take up. You know, to me, the basic thing is that we talk about our challenges that we face with providing adequate services to areas of the city. And I think philosophically, I have to question, you know, I understand we gained some state shared revenue and others, but I have to question whether when we constantly talk about our challenges and how thinly stretched we are to provide services, why we are bringing in individual lots that, while we may say the probability of receiving calls is minor on each individual lot, if we have 70 or 80 all of a sudden, that's quite a sizable number. And the question is, why are we taking on new responsibilities when we are admittedly having a difficulty fulfilling our existing obligations? I think it's something we need to look at. So yeah. I think it'd be very appropriate. So we'll move on that if that everyone's okay. Okay. Fine. And have the Transportation Infrastructure Committee look at that. All right. Anything else on page four? Or page two, I'm sorry. Page three.
Mayor, if I could comment on 4C.
4C.
4C. It's a liquor license application.
We're back on page two. Four, Charlie. Oh, yeah, that's right. Thank you for bringing that up. That is not on agenda.
Yes, it is off consent.
Go ahead, Jenny.
And maybe to give you a little background information, when staff leaves a liquor license application off consent, it's because we've received some information from a city department saying that they haven't met all the requirements, city requirements. For your recommendation to the state of Arizona to approve the liquor license application and then subsequently a city liquor license license. What we do is when we receive the license application, the business licensing office sends this information to multiple departments, building safety inspections, the fire department, the police department, our collections areas, taxing, and they send us an electronic approval that says that they've paid, there's no outstanding bills, there's no permits that are outstanding that need to be received before we issue the license. And in this case, in this new beer and wine store on East Main, when we sent out that information to both our fire inspection area and our building safety area, we did not receive approvals back because there was some issues that our fire inspectors found when they went out. According to the occupancy rate, it's over 50 at this establishment. There is two legal exits that are required for that occupancy. There is only, according to our fire inspectors, and they're here if you have any specific questions, there's only one legal exit, and there's two required. The applicant was told back in mid-June of the requirement, and we have not yet received any plans for an additional exit to be in place. So that is why it is off consent to provide you this information.
Ms. Benner?
Mayor and Council, if I might just add, as Jenny said, if you are going to recommend denial, so you are making a recommendation to the State Liquor Board, if you're going to make a recommendation for denial, the state statute requires that you specifically identify the basis for your recommendation of denial. And the administrative code, which is a set of rules established by the state, have set out a number of criteria that you can use in deciding are you going to recommend denial or not. One of the specific criteria established by the state is refusal or failure to obtain all necessary permits and license by the local government. So if the council wants to go forward with a recommendation for denial on Monday night, a separate motion will have to be made and it will have to include the basis for it. And one of the bases that you can consider is their failure to obtain all permits and license.
Ms. Spinner, I notice in the information it says this certificate of occupancy hasn't been issued, but I would assume that there are cases that we recommend approval when a CFO has not been issued, but in this case it appears that we don't anticipate, or right now the judgment is that we're not moving toward that because of the lack of an exit, which isn't something you can resolve in 30 minutes or less. Am I reading that right?
Mayor, there is different situations. We've established from with the prior city council that if there is a brand-new building being built, of course, there isn't going to be any certificate of occupancy. They're going to have to go through the building permit process for them to even open their doors. So in that case, there is no requirement for the certificate at the time we go to the city council. But if there is an established building, this store is operating now on an interim license from the state of Arizona. To ensure that we get all the proper codes met, we hold up issuing the license. So in that case, we do require a certificate of occupancy before.
Okay. So I guess we'll leave it off the consent so that we can take it up if we need to on Tuesday then. Okay. Thank you, Jane. Page 3. Page 4.
Excuse me, Mayor. Just on
Councilmember Higgins.
Item 5B. I just wondered why there was such a huge increase. There's like 30% on one section, almost 300% on the other. Did whoever bid on this just miss the mark totally, or are we doing something other than what was out on bid? Or I just wondered what the general idea of that was.
Mayor Smith, Councilmember Higgins, no, there's just another well added. There was three wells instead of two that we thought were going to need repair.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Page 5. Page 6. Councilmember Richens.
The zoning case on 6D, I know one of the things that we have always talked about, I know I did in my campaign, was about bringing jobs to the city, and M1 is generally a classification that you consider a job-creating zoning district. And so, while sometimes it is appropriate to give a council use permit for retail in an M1 area, sometimes it's not. And I haven't got all the backup information on this case yet, unless I just got it in this packet and get a chance to review it. But I have some concerns about making a habit of adding more retail to M1 classifications. I just wanted to note that. So
would you like to remove
this? I'd like to remove that from consent.
Okay. 6D then, removed from consent. Councilmember Summers.
Since this is in my district, I had the same concern, Dave, that you do about that. This particular piece is on Southern, up against Sossaman Road. So they have a bit of a corner intersection there that would be amenable to a certain level of commercial use, particularly since it's along Southern Avenue. And there is quite a bit of M1 already developed in there. A lot of office space has been developed on the inside. And the reason it piqued my attention is it happens to be next to an apartment complex that I swear, if I were on council at the time, would not be in there. But there's, in this particular case, given its location being directly off of Southern and up against Sossaman Road over by, there's a Fresh and Easy, new Fresh and Easy on that corner. I think what they're asking for was reasonable. It wasn't too bad.
There's three buildings that are already on.
Mayor, Councilmember Richens, yes, there are three buildings that have previously been approved and are built. Each building is about 25,000 square feet for a total of 75,000. They originally asked for about 75% of that project to be able to go to retail use through the council use permit. What's been recommended to you is less than that. It's one building at 25, and then the others to stay with the M1 uses at this point.
So only one of the three buildings would have the council use permit?
That's what's being recommended at this point from the P&Z board.
Okay. What about the other two buildings? Can they use 10,000 square feet of those buildings?
They could without a council use permit, yes.
Okay.
Councilmember Summers?
Dave, I would also be amenable to adjusting that as well. We could allow it in the one building, perhaps, and then keep it out of the other two. But what we may want to do is continue this.
why don't we do this? Why don't we pull it off consent, and you can work on it until Tuesday? And I'm just, even if we leave it for action, I'd like to leave it off consent anyway, because I think there's enough questions. We had a 3-2 vote at P&Z. I believe we probably need to, although I love short meetings, I think this is, there's enough questions involved here that we should leave it off consent and handle it separately, if that's okay with everybody. Yeah.
And Mayor, I would point out, too, this is introduction at this point. You really won't take action on it until you come back in August. So
okay. So this is, all right. We can at least discuss, this is an introduction then, right? Okay. So we can at least discuss it if we choose to. If you want to at this time, or else we can go through and spend the month to talk about it. But we can make that decision on Tuesday.
Introduction, and if it's not something that we're all willing to go forward with, then why introduce it at all?
Okay, well, let's talk about it then. Okay, so we'll leave it off. 6 Delta is then removed from consent for Tuesday. Page 7. Page 8. Page 9. Ms. Spinner.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor and Council, on 7P and 7Q, this is regarding the retail tax incentive agreement with Empire Southwest. Under state statute, it requires that the Council first make 2 specific findings of fact before considering the development agreement. I just wanted to point out that also under state statute, these 2 items cannot be on the consent agenda and require a 2/3 vote. So it will require 5 affirmative votes for both of these to pass.
Ms. Spinner, on these issues, as far as the finding of fact, too, and I understand there's statutory things, we had talked about, and we have received in executive legal briefings as far as this agreement goes. I would really like to have something formal from outside counsel, because I think we feel comfortable with the verbal representations we've had. But I think we've discussed about having something formal from our outside counsel that addresses the legal issues involved in this, okay?
And Mayor, I have talked to outside counsel, and they're aware of that, and they're working on it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Page 10. Page 11. Okay. Item 2 on today's agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on immigration policies. Chief Gascon? While the chief is walking up, I'd like to maybe perhaps set the stage or maybe establish some guidance about how we're going to proceed on this. The city charter reserves to the council, and actually obligates the council to set policy in regard specifically to law enforcement. And I think what we have before us is the official title is, I don't have it with me. That one. Clarification, Immigration and Customs Enforcement Protocol. Within this document, we have both policy and procedure. And I think that where one ends and where one begins is sometimes fairly murky, but I think it appreciate the chief and Mr. Brady for working on these things. I think it's necessary step in the process to provide some clarification and some direction. And as we go through with our discussions, we're going to be talking about the overall efforts. We're also going to be talking about specifics as it relates to this document. And whatever action we choose and what direction we choose to take, we need to somehow remember that this document includes both policy and procedural issues, and we'll have to somehow sort that out as to how we want to proceed with that. But just as in your thought process, as you remember that, because I think that, while I think this council, and in my personal opinion, council should provide policy, should provide overall direction, we also need procedures that are flexible and that give our professionals and certainly our police officers the right to adjust and to adapt and how they fulfill those policies, because that's how we're going to measure your performance is how you achieve the objectives, the goals and objectives that are stated in the policy. So with that in mind, Chief Gascon.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and good morning to you and council members. And I think that before I go into this, I think it's important to continue with what Mr. Mayor just indicated. I think it's important to put this in the overall context. I think it's important to concentrate on the things that we are doing and the things that we're doing very well. The reality that this is about public safety, and the Mesa Police Department, men and women of the Mesa Police Department, have done very well for the last 2 years. You know, year to date, we're down approximately 15% in serious crimes when we were 2 years ago, and about 7% when we were a year ago. Our productivity is up. Overtime has been reduced significantly because the men and women of the police department have committed themselves to being a good public citizen. So I think it's important to put all this into the context of where we are today and to concentrate on the things that we are doing because it is important to look at it from that public safety point of view, I believe. What we're going to do today is give you kind of an overview of some of the things that we have been doing for the last year plus in our efforts to fight crime. And I think, again, it's important to recognize that we have been working with ICE. We started doing so very aggressively from the point that I came here. As a matter of fact, in September of 2006, we embedded one of our officers with ICE to work a major operation, which I will go into more details later for you. I think, as the mayor indicated, it's important to provide some clarity also for our people. I think there's some ambiguity. There is certainly a tremendous amount of difference between the current written order, which was last revised in 2004, and the clarification that we're proposing today. It's also important to recognize that this was a product of compromise and working with a lot of people, too. This was not just did not fly off the sky. The mayor talked to many folks. We did. So this is a work that has there's a lot of thought that has gone into this process. And it certainly will be an evolving process. First of all, I think that for the new council is important, and I apologize for those of you that were in council here before. We're going to have to go back and just kind of go through a little bit of historical perspective here. We, at the direction of the prior council, started to seek 287G training for our detention personnel, and this discussions took place back in late 2007. And for those of you that may not be familiar with what 287G training does, what it does is it provides local law enforcement with a deputation process after training where they can do certain immigration work. Still, though, it's important to understand that immigration is up to the federal government, but this provides some additional tools. I'm not going to read all the stuff for you, but you can see there the historical process. Late 2007, there were council discussions. There were letters that came from this council in 2008 to the Secretary of Homeland Security, that later on there were directions for us to provide a request from myself to ICE for that training. We have done so. And currently we're waiting response for ICE. I think it's also important to look at, especially at that last bullet in this presentation here, the slide. The mayor and Mr. Brady went to Washington, D.C., and they met with ICE, and as a result of that meeting and those discussions, ICE has agreed to provide us with an interim practice where we would have ICE personnel provide us with a couple of things. Number one, we will be able to get oral detainers over the phone when we have someone that has been detained and there's probable cause to believe that they're here illegally. And secondly, either ICE will come in and pick up these individuals once a day, or we'll make arrangements for us to transport these individuals back, or not back, but to the federal facilities downtown. As I indicated earlier, we have personnel.
Chief, Councilmember
Summers. Out of curiosity, you get an oral order from ICE to detain. At that point, once they go to jail, who's paying for that?
Well, here's what we have to, you know, if we decide that the local charges are important to us at that point and we're going to hold them accountable to that, we will pay for the jail cost until the point when we are finished. And okay. Then ICE will pick up the cost until they pick up the individual. And frankly, they pick them up very quickly, so they really don't pay
anything. But Chief, just so this, no, a person is arrested, they're in our custody, right. Which means they've committed a crime.
Correct.
We're going to make a judgment call And that judgment call is if the crime is, I mean, we can turn them over to ICE immediately.
Correct.
And let's say it's an assault. Let's say they've committed an assault, we've arrested them. Once we turn them over to ICE without prosecuting the assault, ICE's sole source is to take immigration action, which is probably deport.
Deport.
Okay? Therefore, that criminal action does not proceed if we turn them over to ICE at that point in time. And what I'm hearing from you is that we will make a determination that if that criminal action from which we are detaining them is important enough, we will keep them in our system. We will then send them off to jail to prosecute the criminal action.
Correct.
And let them serve, if they are convicted, they will serve, regardless whether they're convicted or acquitted. If they're convicted, they will serve time in our penal system, after which, hopefully, if the system works, they will then be turned over to ICE for deportation or other words. If they are acquitted and the system works, they are still turned over to ICE for the federal immigration action. Is that an accurate summary?
Yes, Mayor, that's very accurate. And there's actually a couple of scenarios that can occur here. We get the hold from ICE, and we put the person through the arraignment process, and let's say that the judges decide to release the person either on bail or their own recognizance, because whatever the charge is not one of those that triggers the no bail process. At that point, the ICE hold takes place, and ICE comes up and picks up the individual. Or the individual is held to answer, and we decide that we want to go through the entire prosecution process. That will be completed, and as you well indicated, Mayor, then at that point, once that process is completed, then the person will be turned over to ICE when we're done with the person.
So that's an important determination for us, because if we turn them over to ICE or to the federal government too soon, then we have a criminal who then goes through what we talk about, the revolving door, who is deported, and what we found through sad experience ends up back in our backyard to perhaps create a crime again. So that determination as to whether to hold to prosecute versus to go turn over at that time is important in our process.
It's critically important. In fact, I will go one step further. And we had an experience not too long ago where we had an individual under surveillance for very serious series of crimes. Another local agency stopped the individual. They decided to call ICE to pick him up right from the street, quite frankly. The individual was deported. Of course, it broke our surveillance. And within a week, we found this individual's prints at the location of another crime. So from the time that he was arrested to the time that he was deported and the time he was back, it was less actually than 5 days. He was back at another very brutal crime scene. So we have to, you know, impress upon people the understanding that sometimes deportation is not the most appropriate thing when you have people that are committing serious crimes.
Okay. Thank you.
Continue with the presentation, just again, the historical perspective with Operation Coyote Inn, working with ICE. There were 13 local motels that were prosecuted. This process led to a total of about $1.3 million in civil fines, out of which the city of Mesa will receive approximately $400,000. As you can tell here, from October 1 of 2006 through September 30th of 2007, there were 98 responses from ICE that were prompted by the Mesa Police Department, averaged at about 8 per month. And then if we look at year to date, they have been 61, which are approximately about 12 per month. So almost every other day, we're having ICE coming into our city and working in partnerships with the city of Mesa and the police department in order to deal with criminal activities. What do these calls include? They include drop houses. They include gang members that are involved in criminal activities. They include other serious crimes.
Chief, these ICE responses, these are not individuals. This could be one individual involved in this ICE response. It could be numerous individuals. So these are actual situations where we called upon ICE. Is that
yes,
correct?
Yes. These are situations that we're calling upon ICE or we're working together with ICE on a particular incident.
Okay, so that's not 61 individuals. That's ICE responses.
No, that's 61 incidents.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'll get into some numbers here.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure.
No, absolutely.
The first time I read it, you could misread it as individuals,
61.
But it's number of responses.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. Here are some of the breakdowns in the stuff. In 2007, there were 20 drop houses that were located. There were a total of 312 individuals that were arrested. Since October of 2007, there have been an additional four drop houses, 63 individuals that were arrested. Each one of those individuals has been thoroughly investigated as in a joint effort between us and ICE, and in some other cases, other agencies as well. Here are some interesting numbers also, and we're obviously, as we're evolving and we're getting better into our system, one of the things that we determined late 2007 is that we were not keeping good statistical numbers as to the number of undocumented foreign nationals that were coming through our jail system. We had some problems with the systems. We believe that now the systems are getting better, and there is kind of an overview there. And you can see from February of 2008 to May of 2008, we're averaging anywhere from 6 to up to 12% of the people that are going through our jails monthly are undocumented foreign nationals.
Chief, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
I know these are numbers, and you can extract whatever you want. You mentioned, though, about reliability of information that's coming in. It appears you could read this one of two ways, and I'd just like to know what your read is on it.
Sure.
You start 3172, 9821. You could read that as though there's a real increase, a massive increase in crime committed by undocumented foreign nationals. Do you believe that's the case, or is this the fact that perhaps from February to May, we've got better information, or is it a combination of the two?
I don't think there's an increase in crime. I think it's really we're getting better at capturing the information. It's still a lot of this information is being hand tally, and it's something that I want to correct very quickly. We have had some breakdowns in the gathering of this information, so we're trying to correct that. I believe that this is actually just a reporting issue more than it is an increase in crime.
So that 31 number in February, you believe, is probably low, that there were probably more actual that went through the system.
It's possible, although you have to look at the total number of arrests. You know, February is a slow month, and the total number were 467,
right.
Whereas, for instance, when you look at May, there were 945, or even March, there were 1,171 total arrests.
I'm looking at 7% versus almost 13%.
Exactly.
That may be a reporting issue as much, but we just don't know exactly.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Councilmember
Summers?
On that, Chief, and maybe
can
it goes the same question. Do we know what the numbers were, how many people we suspected of being here illegally, but we couldn't prove?
Previously?
Yeah.
No, we don't. That's the problem that we're saying. We're having some reporting issues, and we're trying to work through this process. A lot of this information actually had to be gathered by hand, and we're trying to correct all of this.
All right. Well, it does go to the same question.
Yeah, I would assume that if the agreement and the arrangement with ICE works out, where we are now able to get verbal holds and things like that, that the system will, in a way, self-correct itself, and our information should get better because now we're being proactive on suspected situations, whereas before, when we didn't have that ability to get, or we had to wait for ICE or things like that, that we may not have even gone that far.
That's correct? Absolutely correct, because, you know, the one piece that I haven't mentioned here, of course, those people are then transported to the Maricopa County Jail, and that's what the final process takes place. Under the new procedure, many of those folks will never be transported to the Maricopa County Jail because ICE will come in and pick them up from our facility.
Right.
Also, which we'll get into this presentation later, but the new order, the clarification, also set up some other protocols that are going to allow us to quantify the magnitude of this problem more clearly. Okay, here, an overview of some of the operations, and again, I want to emphasize, because it's important to recognize what we are doing and how we're fighting crime, and here's some operations in 2007, late 2007. This was a massive anti-gang operation where ICE participated, ATF, and ourselves. There were 136 arrests. There were 85 documented gang members. And these were people that were targeted. This was not a random sweep. These were people that were known to be committing crimes either in our city or neighboring cities or both. And as a result of that operation, there were 85 people that were targeted, and then the balance were collateral people that were associates to the suspects that we had focus on. Next, you can see now going into 2008, we continue the same model. We had another major operation. Again, this work with ICE, we brought in the U.S. Marshals Office into this. There was Eloy Police Department in South River and Tempe. They also had participation because some of the suspects were impacting them. There were a total of 72 arrests. In this case, 20 gang members were arrested and 34 additional individuals were identified and placed in the gang files. Again, that's really important for us because sometimes we have people that are acting as gang members, but they have not been documented, and therefore we do not have the same level of intelligence that we would like to have. Again, you can see the tallies there. This process continues. We get into Operation City Limits, which occurred in the spring of 2008. This was a more massive operation. Now we brought in all the East Valley agencies as well as adult probation. Certainly we continue to have ICE as a partner, ATF, DPS, get them. And you can see that led to 210 arrests. 86 of those were gang members. And again, I think it's important to emphasize the fact that these were targeted operations. We're going after people that are committing serious crimes in our community, and you can see what the breakdown of that operation was. Here are some of the things that we believe that are also making a tremendous difference in our ability to continue to fight crime. Is we're looking for best practices. We're not just acting in a vacuum. We're researching, we're looking around what other peoples are doing, and you can see a list there of some of the folks that we're working with as we continue our policies. And this is important because now I'm going to move into the policy process. And even on the arrest operations, you know, we're even talking to physicians because there are certain things that we want to make sure to protect the city from liability when we do, involve ourselves in police activities. And although we're going to be focusing primarily on the clarification of the policy dealing with foreign nationals, it's important to understand that this doesn't work in a vacuum, that this has impact in other policies. And here are some of the other policies that are being impacted in the process. General arrest procedures, special arrest procedures, and going right down the line, and we get down into dealing with undocumented foreign nationals. And again, I like to put this into context because sometimes it's easy to oversimplify things. These things are complicated, and when you move one, there's one moving part, there are ripple impacts in many other parts of the police operation. Certainly, there are civil rights issues, there are liability issues, and important to recognize that this is a piece of a much larger puzzle. And this is what those orders do, and I'm just going to scroll through those very quickly unless anyone has any questions, because I want to get to the... And then we get into the area of what our current policy that is being clarified. And as I indicated at the beginning of this presentation, I think it's important to really focus on the things that we are doing and that this policy would take us to, because, again, this is about public safety. And this policy is going to clarify for us and actually mandates that police personnel report anyone that they have probable cause to believe that they're here illegally when they're being arrested. And that is something that was not necessarily always taking place, and there was a lot of ambiguity. And quite frankly, we were being very unfair to our police officers because we were putting them at risk by not giving them very clear direction. And this policy will provide that level of clarity. It also provides a very clear level of clarity as to how they deal with other individuals that might commit lesser offenses and they're being cited and released, and how do we notify ICE? Because, again, if we have probable cause to believe that someone is here illegally, even though it might be some other situation, even a civil situation, there will be an ICE notification if we come upon that information. It also clarifies how we will deal with drop houses, human smuggling situations, or what is called load vehicles in the business, which is basically vehicles that are being used to transport and smuggle undocumented foreign nationals into our country, and then how to work with ICE and notify ICE.
Chief, on those load vehicles, how's that determination made? It sounds like there's a lot of judgment calls, and I mean, I guess when you see one, you know it, so to speak. It's probably not.
Yeah, and you know, and you're absolutely right, Mr. Mayor. I mean, when you see it sometimes, you know it, but it's kind of like, you know, I remember there was some very famous word by the Supreme Court years ago that had to do with obscenity, and said, I know it when I see it. The problem is that we live in a different world than the world that that others would like to believe that we can. That we do play by certain rules. There are constitutional requirements that we have to follow, and contrary to many's belief, people that are in this country, even those that are here illegally, still have certain constitutional protections, and those are the rules that we have to play by. And when we don't, we are subject not only to criminal liability, but also civil liability individually and jointly, not only for the officers, but for the entire city. So it's important to understand that when a quote-unquote low vehicle is a vehicle that generally will be used to transport people here illegally from another country, the officers still have to build out their case. They have to see what evidence do they have in order to build enough probable cause in order to make their case. But in those cases, we're providing them with clear protocols for notifications to ICE to make sure that the investigation is handled properly.
Why don't we, I mean, and I'll just go back with a lot of the things I hear. Why don't we just sort of arrest everybody and just let things fall out where they may?
You know,
just let it sort it out. I mean, I've had several people, and I think it's, you know, why not? Yeah, why not just arrest everybody?
Right. Actually, that's a very good question, and it's a question that I get confronted with on a regular basis. I think it's important first of all to look at it from the 40,000 feet above the ground and then start coming down. Our constitutional system of law, it was really designed to provide a framework to protect everybody, and one of the things that we want to ensure is that we, in doing our work, are protecting everybody's rights. If, for instance, we say we're going to arrest every brown person that we see walking down the street, or we're going to stop every brown person that we see to determine whether they're here illegally or not, pretty soon a whole lot of folks are going to get stopped that we have absolutely no right to stop. And so that's kind of the global policy view. As you've come further down, because there are policies and there are frameworks that keep us from doing that, what we're doing is we start opening up ourselves, both individually and as an organization, for both criminal and civil liability. There are protections for people, whether they're here legally or not, as well as there are protections, certainly additional protections for those of us that are here legally. And that's why we have this framework that we work with. I know that it may appear to a layperson, when you see a bunch of brown people standing on a corner, that they all must be here illegally. Well, the reality is that that may or may not be the case. We have seen it over and over again. I think without getting into a particular agency's names, we have seen cases very recently where U.S. citizens or people that have been here illegally have been detained, have been arrested, have been processed, and then the facts have surfaced that that individual actually was not here illegally or they had the right to be here. So that's what that constitutional framework is designed to do. Additionally, on top of all this, we also have to look at resources. And resources are a critical thing for us. We do not have enough police officers to handle all of our crime problems, never mind immigration. There are many places where I would like to have police officers present on a regular basis, and we can't, because we don't have enough people. We don't have enough facilities. We don't have enough people to handle the workload. So even if you could legally arrest every person that appeared to be in this country illegally, we would not have the resources to do so. And that would come at a cost. The cost is that when we tie our resources in some of these other events, then we're unable to answer to the calls for service. Many times calls that are really critical, like, you know, crimes in progress, where we start delaying our response to those calls. Also, our investigative resources get taxed significantly if we start tying them around some of these crimes, and then we have to move away from dealing with other crimes like robberies, burglaries, drug use, gang activity. So if you can see, through my presentation, what I've tried to emphasize is how we're trying to take what we have available and focus on those things that are causing us the most problems.
Councilmember Summers.
That one.
Oh, Councilmember Kavanaugh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Chief, so what I hear you saying in terms of the overall overarching principles that have led you to work on this policy and with these recommendations, really I'm hearing really three things: the overarching desire to follow the Constitution, to make sure the constitutional rights are protected, the desire to focus your resource efforts on fighting crime, and in doing so, creating a tool that has clarity and understandability for your men and women on the street. Does that encapsulate really the driving forces behind what you're doing?
Yes, Councilmember Cohen, that you're absolutely right. That is what we're trying to do.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Okay. As I indicated before, again, I want to move the conversation primarily to what we're doing, but I know that there's always questions, okay, what are the things that you're not doing? And there's a significant portion of our community also that is concerned with this. Some of the things that we are telling our people that we will not do because we want to encourage people to come and work with us is that we're not going to be trying to look into someone's immigration status if they're a witness. With juveniles, we have different treatments that we deal with juveniles because the system is different. A victim of a crime, people that we're dealing with that are primarily on a or only on a civil violation, unless if during that process of a civil violation, for instance, if we run into someone that has a warrant, obviously that person is going to be arrested. So just because we stop someone for a civil violation doesn't mean that you have a get-out-of-jail pass. If there are other things, if you have a warrant, if there are other activities that lead us to believe that there is something else, then obviously they will be arrested.
If I could stop you, because this is something I get a lot of questions on, and I think there needs to be some clarification, and perhaps walking through the scenario helps. When we're saying, what we're saying is that we will not ask a person immigration status if they're stopped for cited for a civil traffic violation. As I've understood, please correct me if I'm wrong. The criticism I've gotten is, wait a second, why would you not ask them if they've committed a civil traffic violation? As I understand it, if somebody runs a red light and a police officer stops them, not under any other pretense other than they ran a red light,
right,
we have a civil traffic violation. They come up to that person, the person hands them a valid driver's license, and even if the police officer looks at him and says, boy, that person looks like they could be illegal, they've handed them a proper valid driver's license.
Or an identification.
If they don't have a driver's license, though.
It's a civil violation.
If they don't have a driver's license, driving without a license is a civil violation.
It's a civil violation.
Well, that's good clarification.
Yeah.
But if they, at that point in time, regardless of who they are, what I understand is that our policy is saying we treat all people the same.
Right.
So if we stopped Councilmember Higgins, which didn't that happen the other day? No.
Again?
If we were to
without
stop
a license?
It sounds absurd. It sounds absurd, but I think we have to look at it in this context. And please correct me if I'm wrong, because this is how I understand it. If we stopped Councilmember Higgins, she ran a red light. She doesn't have her driver's license, but she happens to have some other acceptable thing. We would not pull her out of the car and question her as to her immigration status because there's no real connection or nexus or whatever fancy word you want to use on that. And that's what we're saying. Now, on the other hand, if she has a suspended license, if she has a forged license, one that's obvious, we've now moved, as I understand it, from the civil violation into a different crime and a different thing. And at that point in time, the police officer will have the discretion to say, wait a second, it's not that you ran the red light anymore. You've tried to pass off a bogus driver's license to me, or there's something that doesn't look right here that now we've moved into a different level of crime. Am I understanding that correctly, or am I missing something?
Mr. Mayor, you're absolutely correct. And certainly if you're passing a forged document, then we have a felony. That person will be arrested, and then there will be processed.
So if everything is right on with a running the red light, a civil violation, you normally would not delve into somebody's immigration status, even Councilmember Higgins.
That is correct.
And so what we're saying is that that's really not a radical standard we're applying here. That's sort of normal operating procedure, which is you can't make that giant jump from you ran a red light, I know you've got a valid license, but I'm going to start questioning you about anything and everything else.
You're absolutely correct, Mr. Mayor. And not only is it kind of standard protocol, but it's really the most thoughtful and lawful way to deal
with
it's
the law. It's the rules.
To deal with the current rules.
Councilmember Summers.
I was going to save this to the end, but I guess I'll play off that one. If somebody has a valid driver's license, we're going to assume that the state has done their due diligence. They've checked. We don't issue licenses in this state to illegal undocumented residents.
No, right? I'm sorry, Mr. Councilman Summers. Actually, that's incorrect. If prior to 1996, you did not have to show that you were here legally. So there are people on the streets that have valid Arizona licenses, driver's licenses that are here illegally.
Okay, but since 1996, for the past 12 years, you have to show that you're here legally?
Yes.
Okay, so the vast majority then, we'll just assume, for the most part, you have a valid license. You're probably here legally unless you've been here a very, very long time. If Councilmember Higgins is pulled over again and...
When Councilmember
Higgins is pulled over...
What did you do wrong today?
He started it, it's her day in the barrel. So, and she does not have her license with her and has no proof of identification, then where are we then as far as we have an individual who is... been pulled over for a civil violation of running a red light who now does not have a valid or does not present a valid motor vehicle license to the officer, does not have identification, how do we even know who she is?
Okay, and it's important to make the distinction because you're adding another ingredient. You're adding the ingredient of no identification. You can have identification but not have a valid driver's license. If you do not have identification, you will be booked. And then you will be processed through our jail. And if we determine through probable cause that you're here, without authority, that you're here illegally, then ICE will be contacted. But you could be driving without a valid driver's license but have valid identification. And that could take many different forms.
And I guess the point is, and once again, boy, you can go through endless scenarios. And that's, I think that's Councilmember Summers, certainly not mine.
Sure.
What I'd like to think is that there are really two separate incidences going on here, and sometimes we look at this as one thing. We stop somebody for a traffic violation. Why don't we go through the whole run through the whole gamut?
Right.
And from what I'm hearing from you is that, you know, if it's simply the traffic violation and the identification is in line, by law, that's where it stops. We issue the citation, we accept the identification, and we go on with life.
And let me read.
If there's something, well, can I finish
this? Yeah, please.
If there's something out of line at that point of the process, we've really, as I understand it, moved into a different process. We have invalid ID, we have no ID, no ID at all, and that's really the traffic violation stopped here, and we have, as you've stated, now we have a criminal act, which is driving an automobile with no ID, no license, no ID at all.
Correct.
Then they will move into the system, and we can then bring into what we're talking about.
Okay. And we would, by the way. It's not that, you know, if we have absolutely no identification, they would be arrested. And then, you know,
but in a sense, even though it's one physical activity, those are really two separate, almost incidences.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. Okay.
But an important distinction.
Councilmember Summers just said, but it's an important distinction that really at some point one ends and the other one begins, and that's when we can put them in the system. Vice Mayor?
Yes.
Since we're on this topic right now, I just want to expand just a little bit. What methods do we have for verification of that ID? What databases are we going through? If we get a license, obviously motor vehicle for the state, we can run that and get
Correct. Get
our information back. But any other identification, do we have any means of verifying that other than just looking at it and saying it looks okay?
Yeah, it's a yes and no in the field. We generally do not have the means to identify, for instance, foreign licenses or some other forms of ID. Certainly, when we do take people into custody, if we take the information, sometimes we can, but it's a more in-depth process. You have to do some telephonic verification. Sometimes you can do it from the field, but it's certainly not an automated process. So the officer has to use some judgment and discretion. They have to look at the document. They have to look at the totality of the circumstances. They're going to make a value judgment as to whether this is a valid identification or not.
Which gets back to what you talked about at the beginning. At the most base level, this is all about the officer in the field.
That's right.
And what we require of him and her and what tools and directions we give to him or to her. Because they're going to be making judgments, and they're not as, you know, it's nice to sit here in this room and come up with these nice little prepackaged examples or scenarios, but when you're out in the field, you know, my guess is that there's no real normalcy. Everything has a little bit slightly different feel, a little different look.
Yes, if you recall, one of the things that I mentioned yesterday, this is about the officer at 2 o'clock in the morning that is holding maybe two or three radio calls, that is listening to the radio to make sure that no other police officer needs help at that moment. And it's making a traffic stop, and it's trying to make a judgment under sometimes difficult and stressful situations and trying to do the best that they can. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to provide those officers with clarity. We want to make sure that he or she is given the support of the organization through proper policies and training to make the best judgment that they can at that moment.
Okay. Vice Mayor?
Mayor, if I may. So whenever we're on traffic stops right now, I just want to finish the whole clarity issue.
Sure.
When we make a traffic stop, there is ID required, registration, and insurance.
Yes.
And everybody by constitution is to be treated the same.
Correct.
So regardless of your background, if you do not have ID, that's treated one way. If you don't have insurance, if you don't have registration, again, we can check the registrations. Now, out-of-state registration, do we have records or just in-state?
Out-of-state, we only have if they're wanted through our presence in the field. Yeah, I mean, we could go again. That's when you got to start then dialing and calling people and stuff like that. Yes.
Okay. What about insurance? Because that is a critical problem that we have lots of times of no insurance. Where does that fall under in statutes, and where does it lie as far as?
Individuals are required to have proof of insurance with them. If they don't, it's a civil violation, and we cite for it. And I want to, maybe I should take one step back here for a second. If you don't have a driver's license, the car is going to get impounded, even if you have valid identification. So it's important to understand that that person is not going to drive away from the scene. And I'm glad, Vice Mayor Jones, that you provided me this opportunity, because it's important to understand. You get stopped for a civil violation. You do not have a driver's license, but you have valid identification. The car gets impounded. You get cited for the civil violation if you have valid identification. If you don't have identification, then not only does the car get impounded, but you go to jail. If you do not have proof of insurance, you get cited for that as a civil violation.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I want to just take it one step further then, because you talked about when it changes from just a routine traffic stop to if it becomes an accident. And that is where a lot of our constituency, especially in my neck of the woods, has a lot of frustration in that realm.
Right.
Where do we go at that point? When does it change?
Well, unless the accident was caused by a criminal violation, you're still on the civil side of the house. Okay. For instance, assuming that you were not recklessly driving and you just failed to stop for a red light, or you follow someone too closely and you collided with them, and let's assume that that was the only violation, you still have only a civil violation. Now, if you do not have a driver's license, the vehicle is going to get impounded. You're going to get cited for the traffic violation. There will be a traffic report that will document the fact that you were the party at fault. And then from that point on, the process will take on, with their insurance companies and the courts and all that. If there was a criminal underlying event that led to the collision, let's say you were driving 20 miles over the speed limit, or you were driving, the officer can establish that you were driving recklessly, then you enter into the criminal arena, and then the individual will be arrested. Or if the person was driving, generally driving under the influence, those kind of things.
Okay, because the frustration expressed to us oftentimes is, I got hit, they didn't have insurance, the officer just took some basic information, that person went on their way, and I'm left to handle all the other stuff, the insurance, and there's an extreme frustration there.
Yeah, if they don't have a license, they're required to impound the vehicle. And like I said, if it's a civil violation that led to, a civil infraction that led to the traffic accident, they get cited for that.
Well, I think, the Vice Mayor makes a great point, and as I'm thinking about that, it appears as though one of the complexities of this immigration issue is that, let's say that the person that hit you and has an accident is a U.S. citizen. We have that problem. That's a huge problem of uninsured motorists.
Absolutely.
And we take care of that as best we can through the civil system,
right,
through the courts. And I think one of the demands that are being placed on us that are troublesome is that we're wanting to use immigration law to handle. And I can understand the frustration of people. But the fact is, let's say the person that hits us, the same scenario, are they a citizen, born here, no question, Are they here questionably? The fact is, on one scenario, we accept the fact that it's a civil issue, and as much as we don't like it, as much as it's unfair, as much as it's unjust, the civil route is the way we take it. But on the other hand, we somehow now want to use immigration law to enforce a civil action, which we don't have the tool of on the tools for anything. And I think that's one of the complexities and one of the challenges we have, is that we're being asked to utilize immigration law to handle a lot of social problems and social ills that we seem to have to live with on the one hand, whereas we want to take immigration law and handle on the other hand. And I think that's where we come into conflict.
And
I can understand the frustration, but I can also recognize the rules and the laws and the fact that this is why we have, you know, equal protection and due process, things like that, so that we don't maybe take one thing and use it to try and address other issues. Vice Mayor.
Because again, legally, constitutionally, everybody's treated the same, regardless of background.
Yes.
So if we want to go down a path, we have to make sure it applies across the board. And I'm not sure we want to go down that way.
Yes. Right.
Okay, I'm sorry. We're probably going to let you finish out your slides here now and then ask questions.
We're almost done. Obviously this is complex. It's not only this order, but the impact of many other orders. So what we are requesting is a approval from council or assent from council to give us 120 days to provide the training. One of the things that I want to make sure is that we have a very small cadre of trainers, because it's really important that the training be very accurate. There will be, just like you have a lot of what-if questions, the cops are going to have even more than you do. And so we cannot do this by video either. We really need to have live instructional settings. Also, we want to make sure that we do not incur any overtime in doing this. So the plan is to do this not only in service, but to do a decentralized training. So it will be done on each of the stations. So we're requesting that we were provided 120 days once we come up with an approval of a final order for the implementation process. And then, if there are any other questions.
Thank you. Now, I don't see any questions. Oh,
Mayor.
Mayor. Councilmember Ridge. Oh, Councilmember Ridge. Well, wait, let's. Oh, Al, well, let's do this. Okay, we got about 8 hands coming up at one time. Councilmember Fenter, go ahead, and then Councilmember Richens.
Thank you. 2 quick questions. With regard to the prohibition of addressing juveniles, does that prohibit us from being able to take care of documented or suspected juvenile gang members? And then the other question would be, how does this policy work with the ongoing efforts that we have with the business people in the Gilbert and Broadway area as far as establishing trespassing zones and concerns about taking care of trespassing?
Councilmember Fenter, no. If we have documented gang members, obviously we're going to deal with them accordingly. And sometimes, as I'm sure you're aware of it, juveniles end up being prosecuted for cases as an adult, depending on the severity of the crime. What we do not want to engage is in a practice where, at a school setting or some other setting, we take a young person and start the deportation process without giving it some thought. We want to make sure that the juvenile process is invoked. But again, if a juvenile commits an adult crime, then they're going. The system is set up to treat them as an adult. Concerning the issue of trespassing, this does not impact at all, current trespassing statutes. In those places where businesses have agreed to trespass people when they are, we continue to make those arrests. And again, if the person is arrested, the policy is very clear. We will assess their status in this country, and if they are here illegally, then that will be reported to ICE.
Chief, I'm sorry, go ahead, Councilmember.
No, thank you very much. That was my questions.
Chief, once again, on the juvenile, because this comes down to a policy issue, as some of the will-nots, I think, are really policy choices. There's legalese in there, but there's real policy choices. And juvenile, I think we always think of, like Councilmember Fender said, the 16, 17-year-old gang member. But as I understand it, and how I believe the policy is that there are those who believe that we should be targeting a 10-year-old, 10-year-olds would make him, what, a fifth grader, yes, let's say, fourth, fifth grader, who tells their teacher, I was brought across the border by my parents, I'm here illegally. And there are those who would advocate that we use that 10-year-old as a leverage, correct, to implement or institute deportation proceedings, or turn them over to the federal government to implement or institute deportation hearings as a way of forcing the parents out of the country. And I get what we're saying and what you're proposing is that we will make the conscious policy decision that we're not going to have that policy as or that scenario play out. We will not do that. I mean, is that an accurate statement?
Mr. Mayor, you're absolutely correct. And to take it one step further, for instance, we have school resource officers that are in our schools on a daily basis. They're working with all the kids. The success of the school resource program is the fact that the kids trust the officers to come with them. Frankly, they come with them with all kinds of problems that sometimes are not even criminal problems. I mean, we have some of our officers really deal with social problems. They deal with family problems. They really become a surrogate parent in many cases. And we do not want that level of trust to be broken in our school setting, because now some of these kids are going to say, my God, if I talk to a school resource officer, I could end up being deported.
So what you're saying is, as a policy, we are choosing, we will not use juveniles. And once again, the juvenile gang member, the criminal side takes care of that.
Absolutely.
I mean, any juvenile who's engaged in criminal activity, they fall into our criminal side of our. But as a policy, we're not going to, because of the overall ramifications that come from it, and basically a fairness issue, we're not going to pick on little kids to try to enforce an immigration or specific an immigration policy. That's a policy that you're asking us to embrace.
Yes, Mr. Okay. Mayor, you're absolutely
Thank you.
Correct.
Councilmember Richens, and then Councilmember Summers.
What level of review might these policies come under? Would the state or federal government want to review our policies for constitutionality? What are the challenges to implementing this? Will somebody challenge this in court by chance? What's the ramifications?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly there could be multiple levels, anywhere from individuals, suing us as an individual to, reviews by the Attorney General's office or the federal government. But we feel very comfortably that we have, again, this is a very thoughtful policy. We spend a lot of time. We have done a lot of legal research. We have looked at other departments. We feel very comfortably that this is a legal and constitutionally sound policy. That doesn't mean that it cannot be challenged, obviously.
Yeah. Councilmember Summers?
I was uncomfortable with the last little conversation about the child in the school, because we keep forgetting that it is not the Mesa Police Department or the Phoenix Police Department or the Sheriff's Office that enforces illegal immigration. We have to turn it over to ICE. It is still a federal law, and ICE gets to determine who gets to stay and who gets to go. That's their issue. Our job is to assist wherever we can. I think that's the policy we're trying to establish here, is assist where we can, where appropriate under law. So I was a little uncomfortable with that.
Okay,
that
can
said,
can we proceed with that? Because I guess the question I have is that you make a statement, and I think one of the questions I always get is, well, wait a second, why can't Mesa PD enforce that? Chief, well, could you expand on what Councilmember Summers said?
Well,
as far as our relationship with ICE and why we keep talking about ICE.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, ICE is the immigration questions ultimately fall within the realm of the federal government, and that's through ICE.
Now, Chief, is that because we're just trying to lay it off on them, or is that the legal structure that requires that?
That is a legal structure,
okay,
Mr. Mayor.
I just want to understand this, because there's that big separation where we're out arresting people, and then we always talk about turning it over to ICE. And so we understand at the point of arrest, because we suspect, but in order to prosecute or to process, we do not have the legal, I don't want to say legal authority, that's not within our jurisdiction.
No, you're absolutely right, Mr. Okay. Mayor. We could not take a busload of illegal aliens and take them across the border today.
So ICE is our partner in this law. If we want to be involved in the immigration enforcement, ICE is our partner by jurisdictional issues and by law.
It's a mandatory partner, yes.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, go ahead with Councilmember Summers.
I actually have
I feel used. I have some questions, Chief, and forgive me if they're a little disconnected because I was writing these down as you went through. So I'll just start at the top. I guess one question I have on the policy itself as drafted, it just says a juvenile. It seems a little open to me, particularly with what Councilmember Finter said, is what happens when they're a gang member. I had the same question. Because those kids need to go, if that's the case. So what I guess I'd like to see is a juvenile is a little open-ended. Perhaps it is a juvenile not in the process of committing a crime or excluding gang members, or if we could expound on that a little bit more to describe what juveniles we're talking about, would be better. I have concerns over the last bullet point on page 3 of the draft statement, which says a community volunteer in police service, not including, and it says a number of things. And this we could actually expand not just to the police department, but beyond. We have boards and committees that we sit people on, and it would seem to be a valid policy to say, just add a question, are you a legal U.S. resident, on the application. And we should at least be having that on the application process, not just for you, but again, for all of our boards and committees to check that. Cite and release is a question I had too. There are some crimes that we're going to, according to this policy, I lost the page, but according to this policy, if there's a cite and release and we determine that those folks are, or we suspect that those folks are here illegally, they're going to fill out the long form, document that suspicion, turn that over to ICE. The question I have is why can we not either detain those folks and hold them until ICE does the investigation, or as a related question, how long does it take when an officer gets on the phone or supervisor gets on the phone to ICE, how long does it take ICE to do a verbal order to hold that individual so that the officer can detain? Does that make sense? Did I put that together well?
Yeah, I think okay. In the court of law, there will be multiple objections to compound questions several times, but I'm going to try to. I was taking notes here. I'm going to try to answer your questions in that order. First of all, I think it's important to recognize that this is a procedural as well as a policy order for police department, for police personnel. The training manuals and the training protocols that will be attached to this will provide a lot more richness to this with examples of, for instance, what kind of juveniles would be subjected to an ICE notification and what kind wouldn't. If we were to put every possible iteration that could flow from this policies and the procedures that are written here, this order will be 100 pages and no one would read it. So I think it's important. That's what we're asking for, 4 months to do the training. Number two, concerning the volunteers, I think, again, I'd like to take you up now to the 40,000 feet above the ground look. Best practices in policing for many years have indicated that we are better when we work with people within our communities. People are willing to come to us without fears. They're willing to report crimes. They're willing to provide assistance in crime prevention protocols and in crime prevention efforts. If we tell people that before they can join a neighborhood watch club, they have to pass a litmus test that they're here legally, they're not going to become a member of a neighborhood watch club. They're not going to be calling us to report crimes, crimes that many times, quite frankly, impact many, many, many other people that may not be here necessarily illegally. As a matter of fact, the recent series of killings and rapes that we had, those crimes were resolved primarily because we had one of the victims, the only victim that actually was not involved in illegal activities, that survived and was able to take us into the right direction and give us the leads that we needed in order to resolve this. So we had people that were born in this country that were murdered, people that were born in this country that were raped, but the person that actually provided the key information to solve this crime was someone that actually not only have been here past their visa, but actually have returned to Mexico and really had no interest of coming back to the United States. And we were able to impress upon her the importance of her participation, and she did so. So you have to understand that we're not a board to talk about whether we're going to put more lighting or whether we're going to increase the water flow in a particular community. We deal with life and death issues. We deal with public safety. And if we make a requirement that people that are willing to work with us be here legally, we're going to be missing the boat.
But that particular anecdote, she was not part of a neighborhood watch group.
No,
by your admission, she had already gone back to Mexico.
She was willing to work with us, and she was willing to work with us because other people impress upon her the ability to work with this police department.
And she was offered a U visa?
That came after the fact. That she was not offered a U visa to come over.
And Chief, I guess, you know, just to cut the chase, what we're being asked to adopt a policy where we understand that the neighbor, the person on the street, we may come in contact with who's illegal, and we're saying as a policy we're willing to trade one thing for another. Yep. We're willing to accept the because we believe that cooperation, participation helps us to solve more serious crimes, meaning bodily harm, those kind of things, that we're willing to make at the most base level, we're willing to make a choice. To make a judgment call that it's more important that we have an engaged community versus a closed community, because at that point in time, the murder then does not get solved, and the rape doesn't get solved. And so what we're saying is that we want them to be open because we believe there's a greater return and a greater deterrent. We can solve more serious crimes than what we're talking about here.
Yes, Mr. Mayor, and I think also it's important to add that we're not alone with this. Okay, this is the industry standard by and large. This is a position that major city chiefs of police have taken. This is a position that most thoughtful police professionals and police agencies around this country have taken because it is part and parcel of how we do business. We need people to come to us. We need people to feel comfortable working with us. And the more fear that people have and the more that they pull away from the police department, the more difficult it is for us to provide for everyone's safety.
Well, there are many who would argue this, say, well, wait, you know, if we just got rid of all of them, we wouldn't have this problem to begin with. I mean, is that a realistic view, as in your opinion, as it relates to day-to-day police operations?
Well, certainly it's not. I mean, you know, and again, I'm really echoing what many other people in my position are saying around this country. You know, there's 12 to, depending on whose number you believe, to up to 20 million people that are here illegally. We have a system that is not functioning, that needs to be fixed. And the fix is not going to come with the local police.
Okay, thank you. Once again, Councilman Summers.
I guess the last question, just as a reminder, was as far as the cite and release, how long does it take for ICE to come back with a hold order?
Right. You mentioned two things. You mentioned cite and release and loan forms. And I think, first of all, it's important to understand what a loan form is. When we do a loan form, we don't have anyone in custody. We have enough probable cause to believe, based on a victim telling us that a crime occurred and that this person that is being reported committed the crime. And then, obviously, in this case, we would have enough probable cause to believe that the person may be here illegally through the investigation. And in those cases, what we're doing is we're completing a loan form arrest, which is basically an application for complaint. At the same time, if through that process we determine that the person may be here illegally, then we'll complete that form and give it to ICE with the information that we have. On the cite and release, we go back to it's a civil traffic citations. If the officer in that process comes through unsolicited information or some other information that leads him or her to believe that the person is here illegally, the officer will complete that form and turn it over to immigration.
But in each case,
If the person's in the suspect isn't in front of you is a separate story on the long form. Person's in front of you, that you have suspicion to believe they're here illegally, however you obtain that information, you do it. I guess the question is, why are we citing and releasing if we can detain them? And if we can't detain them based on whatever the local crime is, how long does it take for ICE to come back with a hold order if that's... Again, this goes back to my statement before. This is a federal law, federal
law has to be enforced by a federal agency. We're here to help. So if we have somebody here in front of us that we believe is here illegally, we can call ICE. How long does it take for ICE to say, we do have a record of that individual, we would like you to hold them? Is that feasible? Is that a short time frame? Is it an hour? What's...
Yeah, it really depends on the time of day, and it depends on who you have in front of you and what the circumstances are. Again, this is a very limited area where you're dealing with a civil issue. You have all the protocols that allow someone to be cited and released, and there may be probable cause to believe that the person is here illegally, and that information came to the officer's attention, and the officer will complete that form and allow ICE then to follow through with the process. I think that you have to look at it also from a larger context of policy. We don't want to put our officers in a situation where they're going to be seeking encounters under civil violations in order to conduct immigration work. I think that when you do that, you start getting into a slippery slope that puts our people in a very difficult position. We don't have the resources to do that. And I think there are significant constitutional issues that come to bear.
Chief, but Chief, could you just maybe explain, though, what information the officer would need to have before he feel comfortable getting to that position of releasing? Because there is some information they need to have that they have probable cause they're here illegally, but they're also going to want to make sure that they have information that that's accurate about where they are. Yes. So can you go through that just quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. Before you cite and release anyone, the officer has to have a valid identification and has to have the ability to feel very comfortably that this person has enough roots in this community, that the person is not going to leave the community simply because they have been subjected to this civil violation. In other words, if the person does not have roots in the community or does not have a valid identification, there will not be a cite and release. And the cite and release protocols are very clear for the officers.
And once again, that's a scenario that plays out in items and issues other than immigration, where we make decisions whether to hold, whether not to hold, based on what you're talking about.
Absolutely. It happens.
Okay, so we're trying to apply similar standards across the board with the added involvement of ICE and these things, that we go to that extra step.
If there's a probable cause to believe in.
Okay. Help me understand cite and release. I'm not an officer. What kind of, is that all civil crimes are cite and release? Are there some criminal acts that are cite and release? What are some of the things somebody would be written a citation for and released after committing?
Primarily civil, but there's certainly some criminal events where a person could be cited and released. A minor shoplifting event could be a cite and release event. There could be some other minor low-grade misdemeanors where a person would normally be cited and released. And again, as the mayor indicated, that will play across the board. The officer has to look at a variety of factors. They have to look at the offense that they have at hand, the individual that committed the offense. They have to look also at workload issues. What else is going on at the time in the city? You know, sometimes, you know, you're way behind in radio calls and there are other things that are happening, and you're going to make a decision to release someone where you may not if you have a lot of discretionary time. I think it's also important to know that one of the things that we're doing now that we were not doing before is that we're increasingly looking at people's prior criminal history where we have questions, and certainly anybody that gets booked, now we go through their entire criminal history process before they actually go through the booking process. So, again, you know, I think that, you know, it's important to put this in the context of public safety and resources as opposed to just get too focused on, you know, what if, because you can take.
Well, at the end of the day, what I'm hearing is that in a normal day-to-day life of an officer on the street, there are many decisions that they make, whether it's immigration or not. That and what you're saying is that we're giving the tools to the officer on the street to make that discretionary call based on the overall context of things is what I'm hearing.
Yes, Mr. Mayor.
Is it discretionary? Could an officer, based on the fact that somebody's here illegally, and decide not to cite and release? Could they hold just because of that?
Yes, they could.
Okay, so
they have that discretion. This policy gives them the power and authority to make that call.
Yes, they do.
Okay. Vice Mayor.
Just more clarification on filling out the long form. If you have an individual that you suspect is not here legally and you decide to do the long form and go through that process, what's the status of that individual? Are they still being detained or have you already released them?
No, Vice Mayor, it's a good question, and I probably did not articulate this very well. Long form is someone that we do not have in custody. We just, okay. Let's say, for instance, you come to the police department and report that I stole your checkbook and I'm writing your checks. You don't know where I am. You know who I am. You know maybe where I used to live or the last time that you saw me, but we have no idea. And by the way, you tell the police officer, and by the way, I believe that Mr. Gascon is also here illegally because boom, boom, boom. That would be a long form process.
Okay.
Or I don't have to be here illegally. It could just have stolen your checks.
The long form has to do with anybody.
Correct.
But
yes. But what, someone that is not in custody, but we want to seek a warrant, we want to seek a future prosecution.
What I'm going back to then is an officer, someone produces an appropriate ID, and the officer still suspects they might not be here legally. He just has to make that discretionary call then if he detains them long enough to verify or not.
Well, if there's a crime, generally speaking, there's going to be an arrest. Okay,
in
and then
a
the
situation, yeah.
Right, and then the arrest, and the long form, you know, it's a crime, but obviously the person is not here in front of you. We are being very unequivocal. All arrest, if probable cause established to determine the person is a foreign national without authority, ICE will be contacted. It's not a made or a could, it's a shall. We're being very directive on this.
Now, and when you talk about all arrests then, those aren't just a site and release. Those are actually taken into custody, going down, booking. There's plenty of time to verify their status.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Councilman Richens?
I just had a quick question for Chris. Are you still awake over there? Do we have a requirement on any contracts or bidding that we do to outside vendors that they make sure that they hire legal employees?
The terminology that we use is that all contractors are required to comply with all local, state, and federal laws. And we've made it clear that this is including the hiring of legal residents, who should be included in that.
Thanks.
Is that satisfactory for you? Okay. Vice Mayor?
Then I'll go back to one that Councilmember Summers was referring to, back on the community volunteer stuff. One of those exceptions said community advisory board. Now, an advisory board is something that is appointed to be a part of. To what degree are we talking about there on an advisory board? Just a neighborhood group? Because if it's a city advisory board, we obviously need to be aware that we don't have somebody illegally that's on a board.
Well, I think we're talking about almost two issues. One is the boards and the organizations that directly deal with the police department.
Yes.
And that's a procedural. That's both a policy and procedural.
Right.
And what the police department is requesting is that those be excluded from any requirements we may have that be legal. Now, we as a council can say as an overall policy that anyone who serves on an advisory board that we define, and perhaps we want to require that they make a declaration. I'm not so sure. Well, I'll speak for myself, but I'm not so sure I want to have people on the library board bringing in their passports, but maybe the rest of you may feel differently. But at least certainly a declaration, because I can see where we could be stuck in a somewhat awkward position that we have illegals that are serving in official capacities within the city. And I think as a policy, as a council, we could say we want to make sure that certainly they declare that.
Just all for clarification.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Councilmember Summers.
On a different issue, I saw our city attorney wanting to chime in on the state law issue. So I actually have a different one for you. One of the issues that Councilmember Finner brought up was how do we help out these folks around Gilbert and was it Broadway?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Gilbert and Broadway with trespassing. And there's a difference between the trespassing laws on private property, and then there's some case history, too, that maybe you can speak to. Once you can't trespass on private property and you shift to public property, the sidewalk or bus stop, the law changes completely, how does that change and how does that impact our ability to enforce loitering laws, if you will?
Councilmember Summers, Council, you're correct. On private property, we can enforce trespassing. So even if it's in a parking lot for a business, we can post signs indicating that day laborers should not congregate or people should not congregate on the private property and that you could be subject to trespass laws if you do. And we do have those locations in the city. And they have had different levels of success. When you move to the public sidewalk, though, trespassing does not apply because the sidewalks are considered their public property and they're considered a public forum. So there are very different laws that apply. There are constitutional protections under the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom to congregate. So it has been attempted on a number of occasions across the country to implement anti-loitering laws on public sidewalks, and they have almost without question been declared unconstitutional. So they've been struck down.
I don't think there is an exception, is there?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. We have done a few years ago, we did take a look at that because that was one question council had, and our recommendation was that is, it is very unlikely that we would be successful in overcoming a challenge.
Cave Creek was it? Just recently, within the last month or so.
You're right.
Their law overturned.
Cave Creek did attempt an anti-loitering statute, which was struck down. So our recommendation is that very unlikely to be successful.
Well, and I think it's interesting that if we note in our, once again, that we have to follow the law while we're enforcing the law. And I know that's maybe a foreign concept to some people, but I don't ever want government to feel on any level that they can somehow break the law to enforce a law. And the law places restrictions on what we can do. I think it's interesting to note that in all of the high-profile enforcement activities, how about that for wording, that we didn't have somebody go down to Broadway and Gilbert and just start locking up people. You know, that's you don't see that. And the reason why you don't see that, and my guess is that the odds are, in most people's minds, that that would probably be very lucrative activity. I think that it's interesting to note that we have restrictions legally, constitutionally, as to how we approach enforcing the law, and we need to follow those as a government that is, I know I'm especially, I will make trade-offs all day long as we recognize that protecting basic rights are our number one, first and foremost responsibility as a government, and we have to make trade-offs, we have to make decisions, and every day, so thank you. Councilmember Summers.
And I bring that particular point up to illustrate some of the frustrations that people have and how our hands are tied at higher levels of government. In this case, it's a constitutional right, as has been discussed quite a bit, but that question comes up of why can't we do something about this? Chief, I had one more question for you that I dropped, and it goes back to one of the projects that you had been working on for the ability to identify everybody the police encounter who they feel they need to identify. And that was the fingerprint technology. It was a device, as I understand it, that you'd be able to do a thumbprint or a fingerprint, and if you were in part of a database, it would identify you. It would not upload anything, so we wouldn't be adding anybody to the database. But we would be able to identify people who we had contact with, or at least people who had been in contact with law enforcement previously. And a second part of that was a access to, I believe it was a DHS or ICE database for criminal reentry. So anyone who had been captured, deported, and reentered is part of that database, and that would make it easy to at least identify those. And that part becomes criminal. So now we've transferred from civil to criminal. Those people we can hold and turn over to ICE. So on those two issues, the database and the fingerprint ID, where are we in acquiring and utilizing that technology?
Right. And as you recall, Councilman Summers, actually, Council gave us approval to fund a pilot program. We have not been able to do so because there are limitations into the state technological systems, that is being overcome. The state has been spending some money, and we're actually very hopeful that we'll be able to start piloting some wireless fingerprint identification, hopefully within the next year or so. But the limitation has been the state was unable to back that type of technology. Likewise, we have access to some, you know, certainly if ICE puts information into the NCIC process, when an officer runs somebody out from the field, we would get that information. And certainly a detention order for illegal reentry would pop there. So we currently have that ability. But this is something that is going to continue to evolve. Again, we have a lot of limitations because all of our systems go through the state system. And the state's having some real technological challenges, you know, and so a lot of things that we would like to do are limited to how well we can get into the state systems and what they can provide.
So is a police officer, normal execution of their duty, enters somebody's name and address into the computer, it pops up with an ICE hold, they'll know that.
Absolutely.
We have access to that.
We do.
So we are able, our police officers are able right. to assist, and then at that point they would contact ICE.
One of the things that I did is we continue to evolve, if you will, is that we've made it mandatory that every time that we stop someone, that we run it for warrants. So if there's an NCIC warrant that would occur, a progression of that, of course, now is that I'm saying that everybody that we take into custody, that we run their criminal record. I have to tell you, though, that there are challenges here. In the state of California, it's very easy to run somebody's criminal record. Generally, it comes back very quickly. And the county of L.A. is all consolidated. Here it's not. You know, I'm being told by officers sometimes they have to wait as long as 45 minutes, half an hour to get their return back. We have real technological problems in the state, and we will continue to have those. And quite frankly, other states are getting further ahead of us because they have invested in the technology that it requires to handle these things. So I have to tell from a personal experience, since I became a cop, I mean, it was mandatory. You run everybody's records before you book them. A sergeant would never approve booking without it. Here, we were arresting people over and over again without criminal record. I mandated it to do so, and I got a pushback. Even the media took me on it now that I was going to be taking time away from the officers. Well, I don't think it's the case. I think we can't afford not to know who we're arresting. But the problem that they're having, and it's a real problem, is that the systems don't work very well. And sometimes we spend a lot of time finding out who we really have in front of us.
Well, I asked you earlier how long it took to have ICE respond to a phone call from an officer. You almost mooted the question when you said it takes 45 minutes just to get the data back out of the computer. And I mean, 45 minutes is ridiculous, and that's a state issue. It has to be
right. Yeah, I don't want to confuse that with the ICE call. They're two different animals.
Yeah, they are two different. But
right.
even if our officers wanted to contact ICE just to get that information back
yeah.
through what sounds like an antiquated state system, is 45 minutes. How long do we hang out?
And I want to qualify this. It's not that doesn't happen all the time, but it can take up to that long. So I want to make sure many times they can get it back very quickly, but the systems are antiquated, and sometimes they take very long.
Councilmember Higgins.
Chief, I just had a question. If there's a suspected drop house in your neighborhood, does there have to be another crime being committed before you'll go out there?
No, absolutely not. As soon as we get a call of a drop house, we go investigate, and if we determine that it is a drop house, we call ICE immediately, we detain everybody, and then we let ICE. You know, we assist ICE in the participation of it.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Vice Mayor Jones.
Just to follow up on that, too, when somebody calls in for drop house doesn't mean you're going to go shut them down the next day. We have to do some observation and verify what we're doing before we go in there.
It actually depends. I mean, the protocols, we'll go, actually, we'll go to the location, we'll door knock, and you know, if it's a drop house, it's going to become fairly apparent very quickly because generally you're going to have 20 or 30 people. Many of them are going to be either undressed or their shoes will be taken off. Sometimes they're going to be tight. I mean, a drop house is really a detention holding facility
yeah.
for a smuggler to wait until people pay the rest of the ransom because that's really what it comes to. So usually the officers there will be a lot of problem. I mean, the initial reasonable suspicion will be the reporting. And when the officers get there, there's going to be many times the windows are fully shot, the shades are down. You can look immediately and you'll see a large number of people in a very small facility. They're partly dressed, they're tied or not. And you see a whole bunch of factors that will build a probable cause that we have a drop house, and then we act accordingly. In some cases, if it's an ongoing operation, though, you're absolutely right. We may actually set up surveillance, because sometimes the place may be empty today, but they call, they say, you know, every once in a while we see the van coming in, and those may require a little more work.
Chief, thank you so very much. I mean, we could literally spend all day talking about this and really discussing every conceivable situation, and I appreciate the fact that we have I appreciate the fact that we have officers out there that have to make these tough calls, and I appreciate the fact that we've come up with something that gives them some real guidance and direction and clarity. Hopefully that'll make their job easier, and I don't know if it makes it easier, but at least gives them some additional guidance and direction that will make it more effective. And you know, to get back, I think we're looking for some council action here this morning, but I want to be very careful on the action. Like as I started out, we have a document here which includes both policy and procedure. I'm not sure I want to adopt as we stand as a formal type of a thing, simply because it might tie the hands of the police officers as it relates to procedural issues. But if what I've heard, I think we are feel comfortable with the overall policy that we've taken, and perhaps with a clarification. And I would agree with Councilmember Summers on the juvenile. I think it would help if we expanded that definition, because juvenile, I agree, is a little bit too broad. And perhaps we said something about juveniles that are not involved in a criminal activity or suspect or something like that. Because I understand it, that's really what you're trying to accomplish. Right. Is that not? I think that's the sense of where we are here. Okay. We have other non-police issues also that I believe we want to include in a formal. And perhaps what we might do is give direction, and I'd like to get concurrence of the council, obviously, as to the overall policy direction that's embedded in this, or that is forms the basis of this document. And perhaps if we'd like to come up with a formal overall policy where we can then also include items that were also brought up, such as boards and non-police matters, such as boards and advisory committees, and such as procurement. I think it's important that we maybe take that step on procurement and figure out exactly what wording that is. And so, Councilmember Summers, you have a comment?
Well, I'll just sum up some of my concerns, and you've already hit on the one, is the further explain to juvenile. I also don't see any clarity as far as the officer's discretion to hold or to arrest someone rather than do a cite and release in here. Perhaps that needs to be drawn out. My personal preference would be if they receive a hit that they're here illegally and there's an ice hold, that be mandatory. Well, but I'm getting into some procedure and
specific procedure.
But I think, I mean, if there's a hit in the ice hole, I think the officers are going to do the arrest. Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean that doesn't have to be explained. That's
an issue. You may have to go back and look at that wording and see if you can make that more apparent in your procedure.
From my perspective, Chief, I guess what I'm looking at is it's not just so much that this is the procedure for your officers to look at, but when any citizen has access to it or asks what the procedures are, that they have a pretty clear understanding as well. So it's in this particular case especially, it's an issue not only for the officers but for the general public, is what is that policy. And I think that cite and release as well as the juveniles need to be clear. Outside of the police department, well, still inside the police department, I think we need to continue to invest in that technology. We need to help push the state into, obviously, now what we've learned is updating an antiquated system so that that fingerprint ID technology will work, and then look at perhaps in 2 years when we come back to the bonds, if the system is working, we add that material to the bonds as well when we have that discussion.
If I can stop you for a second, because otherwise I'm going to lose track, but the wireless fingerprint, the technology is moving. The state is moving, and we're hoping that within a year we'll be able to do so. So it's not like we just haven't been able to do it because we're not there.
Well, in that case, as the state moves forward and that system is repaired, becomes more user-friendly, I still think we need to, we as the city of Mesa, needs to invest in that technology and provide your officers with whatever technology they need to access that system. It's not just an immigration issue. It is a criminal issue as well. So we get a lot of benefit out of that particular issue. And finally, I'm looking at the boards and committees as well and adding that line. And I would, while I think this how it's written certainly covers I'm talking about our procurement, our contractors, how that is written.
I think we can handle that in a separate type, Ms. Spinner, yep. As opposed to this primarily police department protocol.
Yes, we can. And in fact, there is a bill that has recently been adopted by the state legislature that becomes effective in September. So we are modifying that provision now to take into consideration the new statute to make sure we are complying with the new state law. So perhaps in the fall we can come back and talk to you about what we have done with regard to the contracts.
I think it needs to be spelled out because it says item 2, just direction on immigration policy. So I think that has to be identified.
Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you. I think the charter does contemplate that the council play a role in providing direction on law enforcement policies. And I think it's going to be an ongoing discussion that we have throughout the course of our term. I think that there will be other issues that may arise after you go through the 120-day training period with your officers to see whether there is either clarity or confusion in terms of what their understanding is. And what I would suggest is that the council concur in the revision or clarification to the policy that's presented to us this morning, that we also refer this matter for future review by the Public Safety Committee of the council after you go through the training period to get a report back from the department on any additional either problems that have arisen during the course of training, or are there community comments or concerns, to be able to look at the policy once again to bring back to the full council if there are further additions or clarifications that we need to make. I think that what is being proposed here this morning does meet constitutional requirements. I think that it does go a long way to help add clarity and reduce confusion or ambiguity for your officers on the street. I think it helps keep our focus on fighting crime. And so, at least, you know, from my perspective, I can support the concurrence in this, but I understand that it will be a work in progress, as all law enforcement policies are, depending on changes in technology or in federal or state law. So Mayor, I would move that the council concur in this clarification or revision to the policy.
Okay, we have a motion on the floor that the council concur with the policies and procedures as presented in this document and as further stated by Councilmember Kavanaugh. Do we have a second? Councilmember Richens, second. Any discussion?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that I do want to make sure that we build into the flexibility that we regularly review this and make sure that it's working both for the officers on the street from a management standpoint, and that we're having an effective policy that is combating the problem in our community of illegal immigration.
Just make sure I understand the motion. I believe that in your motion you were trying to leave that wiggle room so the police department could work out specific procedures and tweak it. And with the idea that they're coming back to the Public Safety Committee and the anticipation that there will be some tweaking as long as it conforms with the policy and the direction that's included in this document. Is that accurate?
Exactly, Mayor. What I'm, as part of my motion, I'm requesting that the department report back to the Public Safety Committee following the completion of its training program for an evaluation of issues that arise during the training so that the Public Safety Committee can report and recommend back to the council on any further issues.
And not as part of the motion, but I'd also, for the non-police items, because I think there are some issues related to boards and that we can also maybe give staff direction to come up with some specific policy wording and suggestions as it relates to boards and committees, non-police related, and procurement issues that we can address at a future meeting, if that's okay with the council. Okay. Councilmember Summers, you have a comment?
Just a quick clarification. Does that include the two issues I had raised about both the mayor and I talked about juvenile and then the site and release?
Would that include that?
Yes.
Okay, so it include the wording suggestions and expansion of wording on those two items. Councilmember Fender, any comment?
No, sir.
Okay, we have a motion by Councilmember Kavanaugh, second by Councilmember Richens. All in favor say aye.
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 Councilmember Fenter?
Yes, sir, aye.
Okay, any opposed? The vote is 7-0. The motion carries. Chiefs?
Can I
Yeah, Councilmember, or Vice Mayor Jones, sorry.
I just want to express my appreciation to Chief Gascon and his department for the work they've done on this. The previous written policy from 2004, one, I don't remember being a part of that policy, and it didn't necessarily reflect the feelings of council members. And in review of the charter, that council should set policy for the police department, but then the police department is the one who determines how to implement that blanket policy. And I appreciate the efforts made here that we are giving overall direction on what we feel needs to be addressed, because, as stated before, the buck stops here. And you're responsive to the desires of the council, and I appreciate that. I remember a few years ago when we implemented an ordinance for party noise, and it didn't go very far until Chief Gascon came and responded to the council, and I truly appreciate that. We still have a ways to go to get that better in hand, but I appreciate the notion that understanding that council sets policy and departments are the ones who implement. They're the ones who find the best methods to implement, and I appreciate what is taking place here, because there's definitely some things that we've needed to address and need to unify and clarify, and we're at a good starting point because we know it's going to evolve. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Mayor.
Thank you. And I'd like to also thank Chief of the Department, Mr. Brady, for working on coming up with this. I personally talked about it for a long time. And as I said yesterday, I view this as not the final answer. And I don't believe, as I think my exact words, we're under any illusion that this is a catch-all, cure-all, final solution to this issue. We will continue, as Councilmember Kavanaugh said, have to look, have to adjust. I think that we're making some tough choices here. There's no doubt about it that this is an emotional issue, and in emotional issues we deal with absolutes, and the real world isn't an absolute. And we're making some tough choices. We're balancing the need to enforce the law, and especially this law, which has such a significant effect on our community, with, I don't want to say the constraints, because I don't view the Constitution as a constraint, and I hope we never view the Constitution as a constraint. And so I hope that we never, as a government, view that we are limited by the Constitution. We are, as I've said, we are here to uphold and to protect and the constitutional rights we have. And the second we start looking those as constraints, I think we're really treading on thin ice. So I appreciate the approach. I appreciate the tough decisions that are made to balance those rights and the overall goal of enhancing public safety. It's not a popular decision, because once again, in the emotional nature of this argument, there are those who claim we can do this, we can do that, this is easy, this is straightforward, and we recognize that in the real world, that's fantasy land, that is not reality. And we're dealing with a serious issue, and I appreciate the efforts of everybody to come up with something, and the council for their input and their concurrence with this. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Next item on the agenda, hear reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Okay, nothing. Mr. Brady, schedule of meetings and general information.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. Just a reminder to the council that Tuesday, July 8th at 7:30 a.m. is the Mayor's Breakfast, the Building of Better Mesa, which will be at the Mesa Convention Center. And then that afternoon, that evening, we'll have our City Council study session and council meeting, and there will be a study session item before the council meeting. There's a topic we want to review, some of the legislation that the state passed, both for and against cities, so we want to visit some of the impacts it's going to have on Mesa. And then our after that'll be our final meeting before the summer break, and then we will come back on August 14th for our first study session after the July 8th meeting. Thank you,
Mr. Brady. Next items from citizens present. Ms. Crocker, do we have any requests?
No requests, Mayor.
There being no requests to speak, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Motion by Councilmember Richens, second by the Vice Mayor. All in favor, aye.
Aye. Aye.
Mr. Finter?
Aye.
Okay. The motion is unanimous and is carried. We'll now move into a special council meeting and executive session to discuss the city's position regarding contracts. And this is primarily mediation settlement, memorandum agreement between the City of Mesa and the Roosevelt Water Conservation District, Entertain a motion, or we'll move into the special session. Do I have to have a motion?
You call the special meeting, but then you ask for a motion to enter into executive session.
Ask for a motion to enter into executive session. Thank you. Moved by Councilmember Richens, second by Councilmember Summers. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? We're moving now into executive session. Alex, you already there?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You agree?
I agree. Thank you.
Okay. Unanimous. We're moving into executive session. Thank you very much.